This episode, Walk of Punishment, was written and directed by both David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, the show's creators. Now, David Benioff's dad was a former senior partner and chairman of Goldman Sachs. He was also a former chairman of the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board appointed by George Bush Jr. He also served as the director of the National Economic Council. And you know what we got to say about that, Chisel?
You're nothing without your daddy. Your daddy ain't here.
All right, that works.
No, really, David Benioff is great. He certainly got to where he is.
We're big fans.
Right. So, episode 3. Wow. We got some shizzle happening now. In the first few episodes is a bit of table setting. This is the big first course, or maybe the amuse-bouche. You know, we're getting ready. Some food is being put down on that table setting. And we open up with a lousy shot.
Yeah, several.
Several, right.
I have no idea if this scene is in the book. I mean, the scene is in the book, but I don't remember if the archer is this terrible. But I know that while I was sitting there watching, I'm going, there's no way this guy's going to hit this shot.
Right.
And I fully expected him to hit the shot, and I would just go, okay, yeah, we're taking all this license. But no. And I thought they handled it really well.
Right. So, I mean, let me get this right. So you, when you saw it, you figured, you just knew this guy, Edmure, was incompetent.
Well, no. I just thought that the idea that a guy in that kind of wind is going to step up and just hit the stuff.
And what's the big deal about hitting it anyways? Yeah. Why not light him on fire right there?
Right.
Push him away.
That's what my head did. I am by nature critical.
That's true.
Yes.
So, well,
but it was really well handled and kind of put me in my place as an audience member to just shut up and let them tell the story.
Right. I mean, it was two great introductions. One to Edmure. We immediately get an idea that this guy is a bit ineffectual.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant introduction to the Blackfish.
Oh, it's perfect. Yeah.
And one of the things I kind of dug too was, you know, we get an allusion to this by one of our favorite characters in the next episode, if not this one, where the Queen of Thorns talks about, you know, the power of your sigil and your words. So, you know, River Run in the Tully family, their sigil is the fish, and it doesn't invoke terror or as cool as the wolf or the lion, but I really dug what the set dressing they had on the dock with those two, I don't know if it's river trout or some kind of fish, right, just wrapped around the pole. And I thought that it was a nice setting, and it kind of made the sigil look cool.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got to think that they would try to make their sigil look cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right.
And yeah, I mean, I think all the way through the series, not just the set dressing, but the entire design element from lighting on down is just incredible. And it's really what got me through season one, because I was not a fan of the show.
Right. You've mentioned that, how the season, the first season kind of flopped for you, and it got better and better. I mean, would you agree this?
Yes. I think it's much better, and this season is the best of the three so far.
Right.
But I would definitely say that the design in the first season got me through it.
Right. And I love the fish scale armor they're wearing. So, you know, like you see the Blackfish with that, just the top part of what which would normally be like chainmail or something. And it's just overlaid black mail or something. And it looks like fish scales.
Well, and there's some of that in the north you get, and especially with Jojen and Mira, you get scales that look like leaves.
And did they show that already?
A little bit.
Nice. I missed that.
There haven't been a lot of close-ups, but you see when the armor is there, you know, the Lannister armor that Jaime wears at one point, the gold armor, looks like gold coins. You know, there's
no, I missed
really,
that.
There's some really interesting stuff.
Great. Well, thank you for bringing that up. So we do meet the Blackfish in this. And what we also get is a little Robb Stark bitch slap. I mean, he really puts his uncle in his place.
Yes, for good reason.
Right. So, I mean, let's remind the audience what happened here was Edmure does not do what he was told. He doesn't check in to see what the king wants him to do. So he takes over, what was it, he takes over a fort, or?
If I remember right, it's, I have no idea. But it's a mill, isn't it?
Right. So he captures a mill, and in it he gets to, you know, relatives of the Lannisters, but, you know, they're not up there. Right. They're not up there. And Robb just puts him in his place. He lets him know, yeah, yes, you won a little battle, but I haven't sued for peace to get my sisters back. Do you think Tywin Lannister is going to sue for peace to get some distant nephews of his back?
14.
So he says, no, of course, Edmure, that is. And then Robb tells him, well, you would have known that what I wanted to do was draw Lannister or Tywin Lannister into the North so I could fight him on my terms if you would have checked in with me, but you didn't. So now give me your hand because I'm going to slap you.
Yes. And there's a nice little moment there when he calls him first nephew, I think, and then Robb.
Right.
And gets reminded that, no, it's...
By the Blackfish.
Yes. It's your king.
Right. Your grace. Yes. And I think what this does is show two things about Robb. One, it shows him in a kingly way.
Yes,
and two, that, you know, generalship. He had a plan. He's thinking about how to fight this war. It's not just brute strength. So it shows his competence as a leader.
And it shows someone that we've just met in the Blackfish, but who clearly has ability and the respect of the people around him, how he's been treated on screen, treating Robb with respect and deference, which is something that helps that actor look like a king.
Exactly. I love that you said deference.
Thank you.
So we move on to the second scene. We have some big moves at the small council. And you just can't drag a chair across the floor without invoking the ghost of J.T. Walsh from Sling Blade.
Yeah, good dead guy.
Good dead guy. I thought this was very well done. The silence was so loud. They said nothing and said so much.
Well, and honestly, with the chair drag itself, I can't. I mean, that's a great choice, the J.T. Walsh bit. But I honestly, and judge me if you will, but I think of the moment at the beginning of Men in Black when Will Smith drags the chair while they're all going through their little testing.
Right.
Either way, it's classic bit. Classic bit.
You can't see this audience, but I am silently judging.
Yeah.
J.T. Walsh and Will Smith.
Men in Black is a good movie.
It is a good movie, actually. It's fun. Degraded thereafter. But anyways, back to Game of Thrones.
What were we talking about?
I love the chair drawing. I love Cersei coming in, seeing where people are seated, and, you know, just picking up her chair and moving it over next to Daddy. And then, you know, setting up for... And Tyrion's here the whole time. So, you know, he lets people kind of rush by. He doesn't know why he's even there. Everyone, you know, Peter, the brown noser, runs past Varys to grab the seat, you know, to the immediate left. And he's so proud of himself for getting that. And Varys has his little, And we see Pycel, who, why is this guy even on the small council? And Tyrion's just left there wondering, you know, what's the big rush? And then, you know, Cersei puts her chair down and he one-ups her.
He does, in the only way left open to him.
Right. And this little bit, we get, we're reminded of the fact that Peter Baelish is now Lord Baelish, having been giving the title of Lord of Harrenhal.
Which they don't possess yet.
Right, because that...
or anymore, I guess. They did.
Right.
And now they don't.
And
they might again.
Remind me, Eric, is this in the series yet? Have they talked about the history of Harrenhal and what happened there?
If they have, they haven't gone in depth.
In depth, right. And very briefly, what...
It's the Winchester Mansion.
Explain, please.
Of Westeros. The Winchester Mansion in San Francisco. You don't know this?
I don't know this.
If you guys don't know this, you should. It's one of the great, terrible tourist traps in our lovely nation. That would be the United States of America.
Right.
In San Francisco, there is this house on a hill, and it goes on forever with hallways that open into brick walls and stairways
that
lead into the roof.
I have seen that now.
And that's what Aaron Hall is.
Okay, yeah. Well, and what happened here was some lord.
Heron.
He, you know, he had a bunch of money and he builds this outrageous castle. I mean, the thing is like nobody's ever seen, and he's kind of getting full of himself. And, this is sort of like the whole Aphrodite thing where he's getting too big. And so a god punishes him. And that god is King Aerys, who, sends his dragons to burn the place down. Like he melts the glass. Right. So it's a cursed spot, they feel like.
Well, and everyone who's held it since has come to some sort of bad
end. Right, that's right. So, anyways, this is where, you know, now Lord Baelish is the Lord of Harrenhal.
Even though, quietly spoken, Roose Bolton controls it now.
That's right.
Oh, Roose.
So many rooms to get leeched.
That's right. Skin people in dungeons.
Brilliant. So also at the, we get a nice little one-liner from Baelish, who he says, titles breed titles, meaning how he sort of ascended, and one title just sort of springboards into him becoming even more elevated.
Which is a bit of lovely foreshadowing for the rest of this year.
Right.
As well.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong here. He does mention how he is betrothed now, or they're hooking him up with Lysa. Not Lysa, I'm sorry, but with Caitlin's sister, right? In the Vale.
Yeah. I don't... Have they mentioned that?
I thought at this scene, because he has that little thing about how she's always been so infatuated with him.
Yes. But I don't remember... I know in the book they don't say that.
So we'll look that up, and we'll actually look at that scene to remind us, because I'll cut this if it's a spoiler. But I believe Tywin does say our Lord Baelish, who is currently betrothed to Caitlin's sister in the Vale, and he's actually heading out there. And I bring it up because that's kind of a gloss over of, you know, the Vale has not been in the war, and this is a big army. This is a huge army that's just sitting out there not doing anything. And now this guy is basically in charge of it. And they don't bring that up.
Yes. But what I find more interesting about it is that they, if this has happened, and I'm sure it has, I'm just an idiot, they change completely how he ends up at the Vale,
right,
and how this whole thing ends up happening,
right?
They haven't said anything about any sort of betrothal. It's I can go and take care of it because I bedded her when we were kids,
right? Exactly, exactly.
But I don't remember.
That's right.
You know, he says I'll go do this.
Right. That's exactly right. He's sent there to try to get her to take a side,
right?
Because she's been Sweden.
He implies that he's kind of taking one for the team, because that's the kind of wonderful standard.
Right. And nobody believes it.
Right.
Of course. So we'll look at that and we'll see. But something Tyrion also brings up is summer is ended. And this is a theme in the books and in the show, how, you know, winter can last 5 years, it can last 6 years, or just a year. So what's your take on them? Because I'm not exactly sure what they mean by that.
Well, you know, I mean, we all know that in just about every episode, some dour Northman says winter is coming.
Right.
So with this, we get a Southerner say summer has ended in a similar kind of...
Right, right.
...dour kind of manner, which seems to be just to be a way to speed up the idea that winter's coming.
So, I mean, but so are you saying that it's in your opinion that it's not literal? Because I have been taking it as literal. It's like these weather patterns, literally winter can come and last for 6 years.
Yes, no, definitely. But I think that the Northmen mean it literally as well, you know, literally and figuratively at the same time.
Right.
And
I think winter is coming could be a bad thing.
It's always a bad thing, but it's inevitable.
And right, right. Stopping it. Okay.
And I think the idea that summer is over.
Right. I don't think we've cleared that up. Let's put this on the table and come back after we've actually looked at it, all and right. We can see if we got an idea. So next we have the Bear and the Maiden Fair. So this is, you know, the troops, they're riding along, and they're singing a song that's pretty big in the book. It comes up again and again.
Well,
and
which specific troops are these, Jimmy?
Who are they? Remind me. These are
the what do you call it?
The Starks. The Bolton's men.
Yes.
Riding for the Sark, headed by Locke,
yes.
Mr. Noah Taylor. So
these would be the Bloody Mummers,
right?
If we were given what we deserve,
right? But we rarely are,
right? Well, I'm always given what I deserve, what we want.
So we get this great rendition of the Bear and the Maiden Fair, and can you tell us who led that song for us?
Oh, absolutely. No, and there was a big, there was a lot of talk about this when it came out, but that was the lead singer of Snow Patrol.
Mm.
And I'm sure you guys all know the song Chasing Cars.
Right.
Has been so big, but that's exactly who it was.
So we get this song, and, you know, it's great. I love that everybody in Westeros has a beautiful voice.
Because right?
Anytime they sing, it's just lovely.
Well, Gary does have a beautiful voice.
He does, as did everybody in that column of troops. I mean, it was what was it last season? We had Bronn sit down, and that's where we heard "Reigns of Castamere,"
yes.
And that was absolutely lovely.
In a Tom Waits kind of way. I mean, it was perfect for the song, you
right?
Bet.
Yeah. So we got the Bear and the Maiden Fair. Excuse me. And then we got Jamie and Bryn. They're tied back to back on a horse, and just having little, you know, some talk time on their way. And, Jamie starts warning Bryn about, you know, you're going to get raped tonight. It's going to happen. Don't fight because it'll only make it worse. Now I want your take on this. Cause my take was it was good advice, but I felt like there were some digs in there.
Oh, I think it's terrible advice, but. Yeah, it's of course he's not being nice yet, but it's that's terrible advice and it's a terrible way to put it and it's a terrible.
Oh, it was terrible advice.
It's terrible advice.
What should
Sit
Jamie
back
have told
and
her?
Take it. No.
Just take it.
No.
If you fight, it's gonna be worse.
Of course it is. But
they'll kill you.
It's gonna be bad.
He's trying to save her life.
No, he's not.
He's not trying to save her life.
He's
trying just
to
trying
scare
to scare
her.
I think yes. You're right. I think he was just being a dick.
Yes. He's an awful person. Still.
Right.
We
right.
We haven't gotten to the point where we start caring about Jamie.
The
yet.
Redemption has right. not set in.
Awful man.
You know what? What I was thinking of, I just saw this guy in the cover of a magazine this morning.
The guy who plays Jamie.
Right. Yeah. And I can't pronounce his name.
That's all right.
And. It got to me to thinking of
a bunch of French movies.
Is he French?
I don't believe so, but he was in a.
But he speaks movie. French well enough to be
yes,
in him.
As do many in the British Commonwealth.
Oh, so he's British.
I don't think he's British, actually. Here, we're
I thought he was
right
American with a funny
no,
name.
He's not. I believe that he is from a country in the north with lots of blonde people. Let's figure this
all
out.
Right. Well, what I was thinking about with this guy was how Jamie, you know, he's really dirty, and they do a good job of showing that. But of course, they didn't.
Oh yeah, he's Danish. Let's talk about his Hamlet.
He's Danish, right? The prince himself.
Yes.
They didn't shave his head like Jamie did in the book, so that he would be less recognizable. And there's. He doesn't look as bad as I would imagine he would, because it's been a year. He's been it's a year since this war started, and he has a line where he refers to it when he fights Bryn on the bridge. He says, "I've had these boots for a year now."
Right.
And I was thinking of the new movie adaptation of Les Mis and how for that.
Which I'm proud to say I have not seen.
So. I loved it. But okay. the first part of that with Hugh Jackman, he really looks haggard and emaciated, you know, and that's a pretty buff guy.
Yeah.
I just thought, you know, it's nothing bad with the acting or the set. It's just, it would have been kind of nice to really see that this guy is not who he used to be.
Yes.
Even at this point, he is just wasted away, hardly fed, hasn't showered. Yes. He's a dirty, skinny mess.
To be clear, I'm going back to budget here. They're not paying this guy what Hugh Jackman gets paid to do that. To
him. They're paying him enough to cut his hair, though.
To cut his hair, certainly. Sure. But, you know, to cut his hair and then let years of dedication to one's body go away and have another year.
There's got to be some Hollywood trick to that. I mean, Hugh Jackman does it too often.
But you can't require it. You got to, you know. And if you get... This guy's getting the minimum for a TV show like this.
Eric, we know that they can require whatever they want.
$1,000 an episode.
And you think that's the...
He's getting more than that.
Right.
But he's not getting Hugh Jackman money.
No. Agreed.
And I think you hold out for more money if they ask you to do that.
If you do that.
Once you've been cast. And if they don't give it to you, you don't do it. Now, I haven't read this. What we're doing here is... This is the sports radio version of a podcast about Game of Thrones.
Right.
And I'm, you know, we'll call it Chadwick and the Blowfish. That's what we are. You can be either one, whichever one you want.
I like Blowfish.
You can be the Blowfish, and I'll be Chadwick. And we'll just talk out our asses about whatever comes to our minds. And what comes to my mind is that it's expensive to get an actor who cares to not care. You know, an actor who cares about his body to care more about the character and less about the future of his career. That might not be what you and I think about what we would do, but we're not in the position of having been in Headhunters and Oblivion at the same time that we're in Game of Thrones.
Well said.
So I'm just going to put that out there.
Okay.
All right. Now, what the hell were we talking about?
We were finishing up with the Bear and the Maiden Fair, so... Let's move on to the fourth scene, and that's Gendry.
Yes.
Gendry applies to be a smith.
And here's the thing. There's always a blacksmith. Every single series of fantasy novels ever, there's a blacksmith who is a huge part of it. You know, Wheel of Time, absolutely. The various and sundry books by... Raymond Feist, Terry Brooks, David Eddings, Margaret Weiss, these all have a blacksmith. So here we got our blacksmith.
Right, and it's essential, because you can't have a war without a blacksmith. Somebody's got to make your weapons.
Absolutely, and you've got to have one guy who they can talk about as having shoulders the size of whatever shoulders you're supposed to
have. Oh, right. Now, he's one of the faves out there, this kid.
Oh, sure.
And so, but, you know, also in the scene, something comes up. We see Hot Pie. They don't make a big deal about him being a baker on the show, but in the books, you absolutely know that he's a baker. That's what he did in...
He was an apprentice.
He was an apprentice baker.
And when they were in Harrenhal, he got...
He was, right. He was working at it again. And, you know, what you don't know is that Eric here is also... damn good baker. He makes a good loaf.
I do. I make bread 3 or 4 times a week.
Yeah, you see? So,
this bread machine crap.
No, I mean, this guy, he makes it, you know, he's not catching the yeast from the air, but he's not too far away from that either.
I can do that. What are you talking about?
Okay, I'm staying corrected.
I eat the grapes before they get to that point, or whatever other... fruit or vegetable you would like to use to harvest the yeast from the air.
And that's how you do it.
That's one of the ways, certainly. The easiest way to make your own yeast at home is to use grapes. Leave them out, you know, get them a little wet every once in a while, and then wait for the yeast to show up and harvest it off the
back. Wow, this is a whole new podcast.
Yeah, it is.
The excitement of bread making.
No, I don't do that. I buy active dry yeast, and from there...
So what did you think about Hot Pie's bread?
I didn't eat it.
But what did it look like? I mean, what was that? Like, was that a brioche? What was it?
No, that was a crusty peasant flat bread.
Right. But that's, you know, you go downtown Seattle right now, the peasant bread's going to cost you more than, you know, white bread.
Well, it should.
It's, I mean, better than white bread. Ancient grains.
It's not.
It's got to be better for you.
It's, I'm sure it's better for you. You know, it depends on who you ask. There are people out there that are convinced, and many of them, that are convinced that all bread is what is killing everyone. So, if that is so...
I hate all those people. Well, bread is awesome.
Bread is
awesome. So did you say it was a nice little wolf thing? You know, I liked, and I liked the Gendry sort of was, you know, he took the active approach of supporting Hot Pie and,
yes,
you know, stepping up, like this is a friend, you know, and this is the, you know, the beginning of the wolf pack breaking up. I mean, Arya's pack was Loamy Greenhands, who was killed in the first season. And then we have, you know, now Hot Pie's going away.
Well, and she's lost her wolf, don't forget.
Right, I mean at the very beginning.
Yeah.
So that was that. That's more of the her losing her family.
Yes.
And then the wolf pack is what she refers to as her friends later, like you're my pack, in the books.
Yes.
And this is the first or the second of that new pack of people going away from her.
And she treats him horribly, and then as they ride away, she gives him a nice little compliment.
Right. Because she's tough.
She is. But just.
So then the next scene we have, we're back to River Run, with the Blackfish and Catelyn having a nice little discourse and talking. And if I may, I'd like to geek out just a little bit here. I got some info from our friends at, a wiki of Ice and Fire.
Thank you, Dorks.
And by friends, I mean people I've never met.
Yes. We love them though.
So here's a little history about the Blackfish. When he returned, his relationship, and by that I mean return, it was from, the wars.
Right.
When he returned, his relationship with his brother, Hoster Tully,
right,
the guy who just
the
died.
Hoster Tully.
Right. It became strained. Because Brendan, and that's the Blackfish's name, he refused to marry the woman to whom Hoster had matched him. And this would have been a great match for River Run. It would have given them a little more prestige and some more power. But the Blackfish just said, no, I'm not going to do it. So they had a long, quarrelsome, strange relationship. Edwin, or Brendan, I'm sorry, took on this name, the Blackfish, because Hoster referred to him as the black sheep of the family. And, you know, so Brendan's response, of course, was, well, our sigil is the fish, so I guess I'm the Blackfish. And it kind of stuck.
Well, and he kept it. People would say, you know, it's time to grow out of this childish nickname, and he stuck to it.
Yep. He did it. And that's a little bit of history there on the Blackfish. One of those things too, and I brought this up in the last one, was when there's no reconciliation in sight after Robert Baratheon's rebellion, he accompanied his niece, Lysa Tully, who we were talking about earlier, to the Vale of Arryn, where he served House Arryn. And that's Jon Arryn, who was the hand right before Eddard Stark.
Died under mysterious circumstances.
Yes.
For which we blame a number of different people so far.
Right, right. And
it's not clear as yet who is to blame.
Right, who's to blame?
Who's to blame?
Winter's coming. So the Blackfish was actually appointed by Lord Arryn, Jon Arryn, as Knight of the Gate, which is a pretty big deal in the Vale, which means he also should have some pull in the Vale.
Oh, yes.
And we haven't seen that yet. So I wonder if that's in the future. And we haven't seen that in the books either. So we don't know if the Blackfish will be able to bring in those troops to help our Stark kids out.
Because you don't know it yet, but the Vale is going to figure very prominently in the next couple seasons.
Yes. All right. So moving on, we have the Lannister boys. So we have, you know, the two kids in the tower being treated by Rob, King Rob's wife, and a little bit of legend making there. I mean, what else did you think about this scene?
Well, I thought it was interesting that knowing what comes of that little relationship, it's interesting that they put this scene in there. I'm glad it wasn't too long, wasn't too much. They went in there and he, you know, was impressive for them. It was interesting.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, it just really was a reminder that they're still around. Mm-hmm. You know, don't forget about these guys. So it was a little teaser of things to come. And it kind of shows you the type of jailers that Robb Stark is. And the Starks, you know, Jamie was held away because of his particular nature. Right. But these kids are being, you know, they're being treated well and taken care of.
Well, and part of that has got to be, you know, what he learned from his dad with Theon. You know, the word hostage itself doesn't refer to the kind of modern hostage situation we know. It refers to this kind of thing where nobles held each other as part of a treaty, not as a kidnapped thing.
Right.
So these kids, if it goes on long enough, you know these kids are going to have the run of the castle. They're not going to be in this room. They're going to be treated as nobles.
Right.
The way Robb saw his dad do it at Winterfell.
You know, that brings up an interesting thing, or it just reminds me of, you know, in the book, we have one of the Frey kids who becomes a squire to Robb Stark.
Yes.
And he is just head over heels in love with being a squire to the king in the north. I mean, he is gung-ho.
Oh, yeah, he means it.
Stark. And he has to withdraw that after Robb marries somebody other than a Frey girl. And that was it was a nice little book thing that I totally understand why they wouldn't put it in the TV show.
Well, and you know, every time they don't put something in the TV show, George R. R. Martin's stock and really very reasonable response is that we just can't.
Right.
Painful cuts have to be.
It's too much. It does show though how severe the separation is when he has to withdraw. Like, yes. the ties are cut.
Well, and it was nice in the books that you have that, which you can put up against Podrick Payne for Tyrion. You know, you have those two kind of bookend young squires.
Right.
Which was an interesting way of comparing Robb with Tyrion.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks for bringing that up.
Hey, you're welcome.
So then next we move over, to scene 7. That's, The Godfather Beyond the Wall. So, by Godfather, I mean, this is where we see all the horse parts, just lined up in a, you know, are put out into centrifugable. Is that a
syllable? I think, we'll just say in a circle.
Crop circle.
Yeah.
And Mance has that great line
concentric,
where he just... concentric. Thank you. Mance has that great line where he says, always with the art.
Yes.
Which is, you know, the first take on zombie-esque creatures who are also artistic, which I dig. But the one thing that...
There's method behind their crazy, crazy violence. That there's a reason for everything they do, which we haven't gotten into much. We think of brainless, mindless killers. But everything they do, everyone they let go, everyone they don't, there's
so
a
you
reason
think,
behind it.
I hadn't thought about that. You don't think these are just bad guys?
Oh, I think they're bad guys, but I think most bad guys think that they...
Right, but I was thinking of just, you know, evil monsters.
Their
reason is hate, and they want to kill.
There's something there that we don't know yet. We are not able to understand.
Intriguing. Nice. Okay. So here's a little off-topic thing. I don't know if it's this scene or not, but you know, we see the giant in one of these episodes.
Yes.
And why are giants always bad?
They're not.
Almost always in fantasy, they're the bad guy.
No, they're not.
Where?
Wheel of Time, the Ill-Earth War.
I haven't read this.
You gotta read more.
So there's good giants out there.
Good giants out there, man.
All right, well.
You don't know Loial.
They need to put these on TV.
Wheel of Time, you don't know all of the good giants in the Ill-Earth War. Or the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, the Unbeliever.
Oh, sorry, I felt sick.
Come on, man. Know your giants.
All right, I will. I'll look it up. Thank you for correcting me.
You're welcome.
I giantly corrected.
Giants are good-hearted things.
I don't agree. My
Except
point was, it seems so often they're portrayed as like these dumb giants, the killers, and they hate small people, and all they do is step on them.
Well, yeah, that happens a lot. You are correct.
So, I'm glad there's ones out there that don't do that. So moving on to scene eight, we have, you know, back with the sister wives.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're back at Craster's Creep. Keep.
At Craster's Creep.
Is right.
Cool.
He is a creep.
That's pretty cool. Craster's Creep.
You know, and there's this nice moment there where you're not sure if he's going to invite them in. And one of the guys in the Night Watch, he's not so subtly grabbing his dirk, and they're going to get it on if they don't get to stay here.
He says dirk.
Dirk. Right. It's a weapon.
Yes. Grabs his dirk and they're going to get it on. Yes. And no, you're right. It's, you finally get to see Craster with a little bit of, knocked a little off his game.
Right. Because, I mean, he's one guy.
Yes.
And when 300 guys show up, I don't care how godly, in quotation marks, of a man you are, being so, you know, like he's just not afraid. And it's obviously a show. And I don't mean this is bad writing or bad acting. It's in the book, too, where he's, yeah, you know, he has this attitude of like, I'll cut off your hand. You know, that's a pretty bold attitude to have when there's 300 guys with knives around.
They know how to use them.
Right. And so finally we see him kind of back off a little bit. He's like, well, because I'm a godly man, you can stay here for a little bit. So right there from this, it just feels like this isn't going to work out.
Well.
There's already some tension.
Down, it's cold. People are dead. They're running. Yeah, this isn't going to end well.
All right. Okay. But we're going to see a little bit of that soon.
Yes.
So in our next scene, we get Theon on the rack again, and a glimpse of evil Frodo.
Yes, we're getting there.
He's, you know, he's as yet unnamed. They haven't, he hasn't said who he is or alluded to who he is, but this guy looks like evil Frodo. I mean, he looks like Sean Austin, and we just can only hope that the actor isn't as big of a douche as Sean Austin is.
You gotta get your dork references right, man.
What?
Samwise is Sean Astin.
Oh, right. Samwise. So he's an evil Samwise.
Yes. Gosh.
This guy's an evil.
How are we going to appeal the dorks?
Right.
Your dork cred.
That's,
here to help. I'm here to help.
Thank you for drawing me back in.
I'm a dork from way back.
Correcting me.
I can help you with this.
Yes, evil Samwise. Frodo sounded better, though.
Yeah.
But I liked Frodo better than Samwise. I mean, Elijah Wood is just a better person. In Sean Austin.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
He DJ'd?
Yeah.
Like, actually mixing?
Yeah. It was a tiki bar. A lot of stunt guys in there. It was a weird place. It's good times.
All right. So, you know, here's the continuing question.
Hit me.
Has Theon suffered enough for redemption?
No, he has not.
He still has more suffering, guys.
No, more suffering.
More for this guy.
He has killed, he has raped, he has pillaged.
Betrayed.
Suffering. Suffering on Theon. All right. Suffering.
Okay,
Theon.
It's not enough. Moving on. Scene 10, we have some dick jokes. You know, here's the meeting. Missandra is taking leave of her king. We have this nice little quip about your fires are burning low.
My lord.
My lord.
And there's another one. When I was reading the book, it was Melisande. I for some reason, the way it was spelled, I got very French in my mental pronunciation.
Melisande.
Melisande. I have no idea how they pronounce it on the show, but every time they're...
We'll just call her the Red Lady.
From mine. Yeah, that's it.
Do they call it the Red Lady or the Red... The Red Priest.
Witch.
The Red Witch.
It depends on if they like her or they don't
right.
like her.
So the Red Witch.
Yeah.
Your fires are burning low, my lord. So what do you think? It's a bit cryptic, you know, what she... You don't really know what she's doing. If we take it by the TV
yeah.
show by itself, like, it, you know, put that on an island, you don't know anything else.
And it is on an island.
Right, literally.
Yeah.
But figuratively, if we put it on the island...
Yes.
We don't know really what she means
beyond the obvious double entendre.
Right.
We don't know what the first entendre is. The second one we get.
So she's off to find something that'll help in other blood and
right.
small penises and you know things like that.
If you say so.
And no more demon babies because he's not strong enough.
Right. No, can't do that anymore.
So we have then scene 11, the walk of punishment. And we get to meet one of a, you know, a pretty big character from the books, and that's Krasnus.
Well, an important character, not a particularly omnipresent character.
Right.
Yes.
Right. We see Dany's hatred of slavery there. You know, she despises that these people are slaves. And there's something I thought was interesting. Tell me if you think this is off track or not. But they cleverly sidestep the whole Jar Jar Binks trap by not making all of the Astaporians some knockoff of a real people, meaning, right. You know, that we see Krasnus and he seems to be sort of Middle Eastern in his appearance, and even the way he talks kind of sounded to me like a Middle Eastern dialect. Yes. But then there's other Astaporians around him that are, as you know, they're lily white skin with blue eyes.
Yes.
So they're not, it's not all homogenous and, you know, methinks.
No, and that is to be celebrated, that most of that is true throughout, except in Westeros, where everybody's white.
Right, everybody's white.
Which
it has some kind of British dialect.
Yeah, I still go back to that. I don't see any reason for that.
Right.
But, you know, what are you going to do? I see no reason for that, but I don't work on the show.
Well, let's talk about that for just a minute there, because yes, that's something, you know, that always struck me. When I first read the books, mm-hmm. I thought, well, you know, it's obvious that this is the world mm-hmm. of Ice and Fire is largely influenced by what used to be referred to as the medieval times, the Dark Ages.
And still is at various restaurant establishments.
Right, right. The feudal era. Yes. And so, the, you know, the pageantry and blah, blah, blah. But there was no reason why it has to be all British. And I had thought when I read it, you know, like what a great thing is if we had a standard American dialect in as one of the families. Right.
As one of the regional dialects. Yes.
Right. And I had thought of one family, and we've talked about this. You have a different one. Yes. I thought it might be the Lannisters. And I thought the Lannisters because they're an old family, but not old in comparison to the Baratheons or the Starks, certainly.
Let's be clear. You also thought of it because they are the most capitalistic of the family.
Exactly. And that was sort of leading into it. They're I think of them as the upjumps, the sort of the newest family, new money rather than sure. old money. And they
and
would
says American to you.
Right.
Which I understand, but I was more leaning towards the Martells as being that.
Right.
And
whom we haven't met yet, right?
We haven't met yet. But for relatively similar reasons, in that they're hot-headed and irrational, except for every once in a while, one of their great leaders is not like that.
Right.
And that's how I think of my lovely country. We are hot-headed and irrational.
Right. So, and I think these are, you know, it's something the show may have taken into consideration. It's like, yes. Why do they all have to be British?
Well, and to that extent, why do they all have to be white? Because
exactly.
There's no reason that this world, wherever it is, has to have evolved the same regionalisms at the same times that we did. There's no reason, in what we can assume is a smaller world, because they traverse these great distances between countries quicker than we could in a
right.
boat or on a horse. There's no reason that everybody has to look the same if they're from the same place.
Right. And
no reason for that.
It's and in theater, it's a common practice in Shakespeare that it's colorblind casting. So, you know, Romeo can be African American and his parents can be Asian. Absolutely. It doesn't matter because it's about the content.
By and large, the audience doesn't care, and the ones who do care can be written off.
Exactly. So going back to Krasnus,
but even then, if you decide that you want for some reason everybody to look alike from a certain area, then. Why does it have to be the same way here? Why can't the people from north of the wall have dark skin? Why can't
right.
you know? Why can't it be different from here? Is all I'm asking. Why can't it be different?
Why can't we just get along?
Why can't we all just leave each other alone and be different and not talk to each other?
It would be a boring book. That's why.
Yes.
So getting back to Krasnus, he's a lot better looking in the TV show than he is in the books.
Oh, yeah. No, ugly man in the books.
Right. I mean, there's one great line he has where he's talking to Danny, and he says, you can be my bed slave. I'll play with your boobs, or you can play with mine. He says breasts instead of boobs. But, you know, he's a better looking guy in the show. And I kind of like that because he's just as slimy in the show as he is in the book. And it shows that, you know, they're not – you can be good looking and slimy. And I like that. What I miss in the costume department is not Krasnus, but the guy who's above Krasnus in the book. His tokar, which is the garb that they wear, is all of the Astaporians have these tokars, they're called, and they're fringed in various ways.
Yes.
And a lot of them are just fringed in silk, but this other guy is his tokar is fringed in pearls. And so every time he walks, it's just clanking, clacking sound. I'm sure they have a whole bunch of legitimate reasons why they didn't do that. One of being it's just not important. But, it's just a fun image.
But you miss it.
I miss it.
And that's valid.
Little subtleties. Yeah. Okay, so moving on to our next scene, we got some short jokes for Tyrion and a whole lot of sort of Chekhovian subtleties being thrown back and forth with Littlefinger and Tyrion.
Yes, and their relationship right from the beginning in the books is something that is, let's call them opponents who respect one another.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Adversarial, but... a matching of intellectual equals.
Exactly. And all the way through the books and in the show, we've seen we have the workings of Littlefinger, of Varys, of Cersei, of even to a smaller extent on the show than in the book, of Pycelle, Grandmaster Pycelle.
Yes.
And then sort of juxtaposed from all four of those is Tyrion. Because he's playing the game. He knows that it's a game, unlike Eddard Stark, who was just, well, that's not honorable.
Correct.
And that led to him losing his head.
Well, and what I find fascinating is the only one of those, and it's this way in the book too, the only one of those that you ever get the feeling cares at all about anyone he doesn't know is Tyrion. Every other single one of those people is out for themselves, make themselves rich, to make themselves powerful, to keep themselves alive. And Tyrion is there for those things too. But he also doesn't want people to die.
Right.
And that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So I can talk to that guy.
And out of those four, I mean, we have Littlefinger, who's just, he's slimy. There's something about him.
Yeah.
Varys, though, is sort of an enigma.
Yes, he could well have the nicest, most beautiful flower of a heart of all of them.
Right.
But he could not.
We just don't know. And the other two are shitbirds. We know Cersei's just, she's just evil.
For now,
yeah. That's all we can go on is what we're given.
Yeah.
And regardless, she's just not a nice person, no. And you know she's banging
whatever,
her brother.
Whatever her reason,
she's banging her brother.
Yes, there is.
And Pycelle is
as
yeah.
My girlfriend keeps reminding me.
Right, incest boobies, okay, so going on to scene 13, we have accounting lessons for Bronn.
Yes, we do.
He's learning just a little bit about what it's like to borrow money, and then we are on to the chase. We have Evil Samwise.
Thank you.
Saving Fionn from the prison hug that he was about to get after he's caught. I love the arrows coming out of nowhere.
Oh, yeah. No, this is all fun.
Yeah, and then, the sort of execution-style double tap to the forehead with the arrow up close. And very interesting when the guy looks at him and goes, "You bastard." Like, it was very intimate, like, personal. It's like, it didn't seem to me that this was a stranger. And then, a very telling, I don't know, something foreshadowing perhaps when this guy, the evil Samwise,
right.
And not that he hasn't shown anything but niceness, but he just looks like,
oh yeah, this is you with your book learning, all letting your,
you're the one who dropped like 15 book titles, yeah, like a few minutes ago.
Yeah, they're all, you know, you can't be a fantasy fiction dork and not have read these books.
I'm sorry.
Wheel of Time. David Eddings. David Eddings is formative. Are you kidding me?
All right. No, I'm going to do it.
Bulgariad.
I'm going to go. To your daughter. I'm going to get it.
I don't know. How old is she? She's 5.
She's 6 and a half.
Yeah, give her 2 years and then read it to her. She'll like it.
So we have evil Samwise.
Yeah.
He reaches out his hand to Theon and he says, come, my lord, winter is coming.
Well, of course.
Well, you know, of course. What do you mean, of course? I mean, who says that?
They all say that.
Only in the north.
Yeah.
So, you know, this guy, he's of the north.
Yes.
Not, you know, that's, you know, you can be in the north and not be of the north. I mean, this is guy saying.
Yes.
You know, he's saying live free, die hard or whatever, like some Americana thing.
Oh, let's not get into New Hampshire.
Yes. Anyways, I think it's very telling there, you know, something's brewing.
Yes.
Question.
Yes.
Would the prison hug have given Theon some redemption?
No, there's no redemption for Theon. It's not going to happen. He's a shit bird, to use your term. He deserves what he gets.
Fair enough. So, moving on to the next scene. We have the hand.
Oh, yeah, the hand is important. The hand plays.
I mean, this is... up to this point, it was my favorite episode of the series.
Okay.
And this hand bit is totally different than in the book. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. But regardless of it being different than in the book, I loved it. I love this entire scene.
Yes. From the beginning, when it's everybody... to the middle where it's just the two of them.
Right.
Where it's everybody again.
Right.
Well done.
So, I mean, what did you think about this whole, you know, the way that Jamie, he saves Bryn.
I keep wanting to correct you every time you say Bryn.
I know. We have a friend named Bryn. And when I read the series, they don't tell you this is how it's pronounced, but everyone else in the world just knew. I didn't. And I kept saying Bryn. Right. So for over a decade, it was in my mind as that.
Okay.
So Brienne, he saves Brienne from being raped.
And he does it largely the way he does it in the book, which is nice.
Right.
But I bought it more in the book because the book had Vargo Hoat. It had Vargo Hoat.
Yes, it had Vargo Hoat. So let's talk about Vargo Hoat.
Vargo.
So for those of you who don't know, which means you haven't read the book.
We should put out there. Noah Taylor is great.
He's brilliant.
I love Noah Taylor.
This is nothing is Noah. And we'll talk about this because you actually heard a clip at the beginning of the show that is Noah Taylor as Locke and what he says when he says, you know, you're nothing without your daddy. And I loved it. I love the dialect, the way he says diddy, all of it. But there is this character. Vargo Hoat. He's actually the leader of the Brave Companions.
Also known as the Bloody Mummers.
Brilliant. And some of these guys in the Bloody Mummers.
Oh, right.
We have a Septa. So, you know, a lady who's part of those chicks who travel around and pick up dead bodies. And she's a nun, basically, but she's a rogue nun. And she's hanging out with these guys. We got a guy who's in pink and green motley. Yeah. So he's like a court jester, but he is whacked out.
Yeah, he's a court jester if, say, he was played by David Patrick Kelly.
Yeah, psychopath. Yeah. And then there's actually a Dothraki. So, you know, in the last episode, Danny says they're the first Dothraki to cross the sea. She's wrong. Because they have at least this one guy who's in Westeros.
Yeah, that dude's there.
And, you know, he's just a big fat guy. But
they have a half-meister.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? Who else? Is there any other of the bloody mummers?
They picked up some of the guys.
Right, they picked up some of the Biter, Rorg, or whatever.
Yeah, those guys are there.
Vargo Hoat, he rides what's Martin describes as a Zorse. Yes. In the book, which basically is a zebra, but more like a horse. So it's striped, but it's not the smallish kind of animal.
So we're saying he's got style.
Yeah. I mean, and that's just visually cool.
Yeah.
You see this Zorse.
You see this weird dude with a goat helmet.
Right. So sometimes they call him the goat because he has this goat helm.
And
because
he drools.
And he drools. They also call him the crippler. And this is important because he has a penchant for
doing what,
cutting off people's hands and feet. And collecting them. And here is one of the things, and probably the most important reason why we miss this guy. He's known for perpetually having a swollen tongue, which causes him to lisp.
Which we assume is some weird, long-lived, sexually transmitted disease.
And it slobbers. And it's funny that you bring up the sexually transmitted disease because on, a wiki of Ice and Fire, they have some great history on every character. And one of the tidbits about Vargo Hoat is that the half-meister that they have with them, and I think it's Qyburn, actually, for a while, he has every woman checked for diseases before he rapes them.
Oh, well, that's a nice one.
Because he's a cautious raper.
He's a terrible person. But
I mean,
he missed the character.
Can you imagine being once over by a maester just to be thrown into this guy's arms?
I can't begin to imagine anything like that.
So here's what I want to do.
What's that?
I want to take a little clip from the book.
Yes.
And this is the clip immediately preceding Jaime getting his hand chopped off. This is the dialogue that Vargo Hoat has right around that era, that point in the book. So just want to read it to you real quick. When the sellsword spied Urswick and the captives, a cry went up in half a dozen languages. The goat was seated by a cook fire, eating a half-cooked bird off a skewer, grease and blood running down his fingers into his long, stringy beard. He wiped his hands on his tunic and rose.
Kingslayer,
he slobbered.
You are my captive.
There is more dialogue between Bryn and Jaime, and Jaime makes a similar offer to Vargo to the one that he makes to Locke in the show. This is Vargo's response.
Oh, yes,
said Vargo Hoat.
Half the gold in Casterly Rock I shall have, but first I mouth, then him I methane.
And then a fat Dothraki takes off Jamie's hand.
Yeah, it's I miss Vargo Hoat.
I mean, I don't know if they read that and they tried to do it. And they're like, it's just too funny.
And I have no problem with that.
Me either.
I think the scariest shit and the most terrifyingly dramatic moments are some of the funniest things in our lives. And I think having this guy sound like Edwin would be just about the funniest thing in the world.
Right, and you brought up...
Don't let me do it. Right. You know, I need something like that in my life. It's butter. One more two. And... I need something like that.
And you brought up a good point when we were talking about this in the pre-show.
Sorry, I need to wipe off all the slobber off my computer screen.
This guy having that kind of impediment in this world, in growing up in it, it's sort of like, Richard III. He's being treated like a monster his whole life, so he starts acting like a monster.
Right. He sees no way to gain respect but to show people he's the biggest, baddest guy on the block.
Right. And, I think maybe that could – I don't know if it could be done without it being funny, but I'd love to see – I would have loved to have seen it, and I'm glad we got to share it with you.
Well, I think, honestly – to do it and have it not be funny, it would have to be so shockingly violent that it could not help but be off-putting.
Right.
That said, I still want it.
Yeah, me too.
Now,
so
I'm also mostly over it because they did such a good job.
They did a great job. Right. This isn't like my ire of, you know, not having a pasty skin, Roose Bolton.
Or any strong Belle Watson.
Or any strong, which officially you've told me, just in.
Oh, it's probably not just in for you guys, but just for us. We actually looked it up and they have, George R. R. Martin has announced on his own website that he's a cut. He didn't make it.
Loved him. Well, so back to this little bit here. One other interesting thing from the book, the chapter ends like this. Here's the dialogue that Martin put. Sunlight ran silver along the edge of the Iraq as it came shivering down, almost too fast to see, and Jamie screamed. And that's, you know, almost too fast to see, period, and Jamie screamed. We don't see Jamie again for like 10 chapters, over 100 pages.
We have no idea what has happened.
No idea. We don't know that his hand was only taken off. He could be dead. And, you know, we've lost characters up to this point.
R. R. Martin loves to kill your favorites.
Right.
And we've just seen a moment where Jamie is not only nice, but noble.
Sets you up.
And you just, you
right.
Now, that's when George R. R. Martin loves to kill people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the idea that Tyrion's still alive at any point in the series.
Oh, right. Right. Right.
At all times.
And just, you know, I just thought about it. Right before that paragraph where Jamie loses his hand, his internal monologue, you know, where Martin does it in italics, which means this is what the character is literally thinking at that moment.
Right.
Earl Swick, who's actually I believe that's the big fat Dothraki, is pulling out a sword, and Jamie's like, oh, they're trying to scare me. Well, I'm, you know, the head of the Kingsguard. I don't get scared. I don't scream.
And
they're not going to make me do it.
Filth like this.
Right. And then bam, and Jamie screams.
Yeah.
So having said that,
yeah,
let's talk about what was actually in the show. Because like we've said, I absolutely loved what they did. I mean, and which is such a pat on the back for D.B. Weiss and that whole crew that's putting it together, because I love this just as much as that book. I mean, I would have loved to see Varga Hoet, but I was not.
You can call him Hoet if you
Hoet. I was not dissatisfied. Thank you.
No, I wasn't either. I think it's a terrifically shot scene. I think the acting is terrific. I think terrific is terrific, terrific, and I had a great time with it.
Yeah, and again, Noah Taylor, with that, the special effect they had with that, he called it a carving knife.
Right.
What the hell? What kind of bird are you carving? I mean, that thing was a machete, and just
a
great CGI.
That's the thing, is I can see Vargo Hope calling it a carving knife, so I've just got to, in my brain, switch it over to the guy's name is Locke.
Right.
Same character, and he does it really well. He just doesn't have any sort of speech problem.
Right.
And I love it.
Yeah, it was a great ending. And then, you know, we cut to black.
Yes.
And we hear a punk version of A Bear in the Maiden Fair.
Yes.
Which I just love, because it kept that thing going, that feeling of punching me in the face and doing things that are sort of out of the box. It just really grabbed me in a way that like nothing in the first season had. Because you know, I had waited for that show for
years,
a decade.
Years.
And you know, it aired on the day of my 40th birthday, April 17th. So I, you know, it was a lot of buildup, and over the season I was like, oh, it's just not what I wanted. And this third season is what I've wanted.
If I'm not mistaken, the version of the song that you're talking about was done by the Hold Steady, which is a great choice too. They've really
nice.
hit some home runs with the musical choice.
Now, do you know? Can you punch that up there on the interweb? Was that a commissioned song, or was that a song that this band plays?
I am completely unsure.
Okay. Well, let's leave it on that. Yeah. Let's end our episode on...
I'm completely unsure and I'm able to no help in any way, so I'm glad you
flapping idea. All right. Well, that was...
Who are you? Where can you find
I am Jimmy G. You can find me at The Lazy Muse.
On Twitter, we're talking.
On Twitter.
I am Eric Grattan. You can find me at Pine Tar Press under a column called The Obstructed Review. And on Twitter, at Totally Kidding.
So what do we have coming up on the Obstructed Review there, Eric?
I just did one on the idea of there being films that you should know or you should shut your mouth. And one of the films that I've just done a review on in terms of that concept is Project X.
Yes. Matthew Broderick.
Matthew Broderick, Helen Hunt, the great William Sadler.
I forgot about Helen
Hunt. The chimps you can eat.
Yeah, like some angry chimps, right?
Lots of angry, justifiably so.
This is kind of, was this maybe one of Matthew's first cinematic forays into drama? Like, I mean, we'd known him as Ferris Bueller, right? Or,
well, yeah, he'd done Ferris Bueller, he'd done Lady Hawk, he'd done...
had he done the Harvey Firestein movie yet?
He'd done it on Broadway, certainly.
Right.
Long before.
Right, and we know he had a lot of drama before.
This was around the time of the movie version of Biloxi Blues, if I'm not mistaken. A little bit before that. So he was at his youthful height at
right
this point.
Any other movies like that come to mind for you? I mean, for me, it would be, you know, if you haven't seen this movie, Don't Talk to Me, is the Gene Wilder version of Willy Wonka.
Sure, yes.
In The Big Lebowski.
Certainly. That's a good choice. A lot of mine come from the 80s, which I think is a forgotten decade.
Mm-hmm.
And shouldn't be. It was a
Real Genius, which is
Real
at the
Genius,
the
absolutely
front of our show.
Mentioned. All right.
Which isn't even my favorite quote from that movie. My favorite quote from Real Genius is, I quote Socrates when he said, I drank what?
Yes, that's a good one.
Yeah.
It is. It's an eminently quotable movie.
It is.
I like your mom puts license plates in your underwear. How do you say it?
Right.
I'm a big fan of that one.
Yes.
Shall that be the end?
Yes. Please subscribe to the podcast. As we've said before, it doesn't take up any space on your media devices. It just lets iTunes know that we are out there and people want to hear us. And also, please leave us some positive or negative feedback on iTunes. And if you have anything you want to correct, say, rant, or yell at Eric or I, you can do so by going up to your interweb browser and typing in comments at thelazymuse.com, and that email will come right to us. So we'll see you here in just a little bit. rolling. Welcome back to the Lazy Muse. This is episode 3. We're talking about Game of Thrones, episode 3.
Of season 3.
That's right. I'm Jimmy G.
I'm Eric G.
And welcome back to the podcast. So, as we said, this is season 3, episode 3, Walk of Punishment. We have director David Benioff, and D.B. Weiss is actually uncredited as a director as well. And the writers are David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. And